There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1207 FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Monday. Live local talk over the next couple of hours, and glad you're along. Phone line, text line 343-0106. We're also going to check in up in Huntsville as today the first of the reopen Alabama rallies or protest hitting Alabama. Tomorrow, I think it's supposed to be Montgomery. Today at 1, supposed to be there in Huntsville, I guess, Madison County, right? So City Hall there in Madison County. So we're watching that. We'll check in at the end of the hour and find out what's going on up there, and check in with Dale Jackson from WVNN up there, as he's going to be somewhere near this protest, because we've had him around the country over the weekend. The president was talking about it as well. Coming to Alabama today. So we'll get into that. Also, as I talked about this morning, it is 10 years since the tragedy of the tragedy that claimed 13 lives, injured 17, and started an odyssey that lasted, well, I would argue, to some degree, till this day, and that is the Gulf oil spill. I know it's hard to, you know, in the background of this pandemic and everything going on, to deal with this, but we must, because it's 10 years since. And there was a couple stories over the weekend I mentioned this morning I thought were somewhat worrying, that at least an AP story and another had said there hadn't been big changes, or if there had been big changes made after the oil spill, I think the term they used was those changes had been eroded in deep water drilling. And that is going to be, you know, a subject we talk about for the next couple of hours here on the show. And where do we stand now after 10 years, after the Macondo well and the explosion and the oil spill that shut down? You think about the shutdown going on right now to our economy, the shutdown that happened to the beaches during the oil spill. I want to bring in somebody who talked with me a whole bunch back then, and we've continued to talk ever since. But I remember we had almost two or three times a week conversations during the spill. That is my friend Ben Raines, who joins us now on Midday Mobile. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Sean. How are you?
I'm good. 10 years, man. 10 years ago. We were much younger. Better looking back then.
And it sure does look nice out in the Gulf and the Bay, doesn't it? There were days there where I thought we were going to lose it all.
Yep.
And I'm real glad we didn't. But, you know, there are a couple of things that jumped out at me with just what you were talking about there. And one is what people call it. It's not the Deepwater Horizon spill, it's the BP oil spill. And that was a marketing thing that people started doing, that BP started doing during the spill, mm-hmm. trying to get their name off of it. So I tell everybody, remember it as the BP spill.
Yeah, well said.
Because, you know, that's what it is.
Well, it's a BP spill. It was the Deepwater Horizon was the actual structure, or the Macondo.
Right. Yeah. There's no question the Deepwater Horizon is part of the thing.
Right.
But, you know, we say the Exxon Valdez.
Absolutely. No,
we
absolutely.
Say the BP oil spill.
Right.
Just to you know, it's a corporate speak thing. They were trying to get their name out of there. The other thing is the erosion of protections. That has happened again and again. And I wrote about that 10 years ago. And what I quoted all these experts saying, after Exxon Valdez, we did X, Y, and Z. And now it's all gone. They've backed away from all of it. And that's why we didn't have any oil boom, protective boom here on the Gulf Coast, even though it's required in countries like Brazil. You know, we didn't have any of the protective materials because there were no laws requiring them. Well, even today, they're mostly just recommendations. The way the federal oil laws work, they're written by the American Petroleum Institute and approved by the government. So we're in that same situation, I would say, today.
Yeah, that's scary to have what we went through and not to have learned our lesson on that. And that's, you know, and I walk this road in between that I'm a I'm a pro drilling and exploration and I'm pro having American resources brought to bear like President Trump has done. At the same time, I believe to go drill deeper and deeper. To do these things, you got to tell us, we the American people, how you are guaranteeing you can mitigate this if you have another disaster. I think that is a fair way to do this. I am pro-American energy. At the same time, show me how you're going to clean this up. Show me how you're going to prevent this, better yet.
Well, and then look where we do our drilling. You know, the Gulf of Mexico has always been America's redheaded stepchild. That's why all the drilling is in the Gulf. There's none on the Atlantic coast. There's none on the... You know, the
Lord knows on the Pacific, always, right?
You know, there's some out there, but they had a big oil spill in the 60s, and so there are only, I think, 12 or 22 wells on the entire Pacific coast. We've been drilling in the Gulf, our most dynamic and diverse body of water, our personal little ocean, instead of all these other places. I mean, you know, everybody says, oh, we shouldn't drill around Alaska, it's so pretty. I think we shouldn't be, you know, we never should have started drilling in the Gulf. We should have drilled all these other places that aren't near as dynamic as our beautiful ocean down here.
Well, okay. So, but the reality is, we are drilling at the Gulf. It is, it's part of our culture, part of the economy down here. But I would argue that you can, and I had Scott Engel, who's head of the BBSE or whatever the new acronym is, on the show a month and a half ago, and I asked him. I said, "Am I being crazy to?" As a citizen here, say, are you doing what needs to be done to make sure that if we have a repeat of BP's spill, that we'll be able to react faster to clean up? He said, no, you're not. He said, we're absolutely ready to clean up faster, and we talked about the stationing of gear up and down the coast. But now I see this story over the weekend, you're just referring to it, that says this erosion in readiness, I guess, and erosion in inspection. My gosh, we have short memories as human beings. I'm not somebody who wants to shut this down here. I want them to show me that they're ready to deal with it. Are we ready to go as best as we can if there is, God forbid, another disaster?
Well, and I guess my point was, wouldn't it be better to be drilling in 100 feet of water off Alaska than in 5,000 feet of water off Louisiana and Alabama?
No, I get
just
it.
Technologically. You know, just as a, we know how to do that. It's easy. You know, somebody could scuba dive down to the bottom and fix it, which can't happen at 5,000 feet, as we learned in such a painful way. So, we're never going to quit drilling in the Gulf until we don't need oil. So it's kind of a moot point, I guess. But I wish people would think of the Gulf differently. It is our most productive body of water. It is one of the most productive marine environments on Earth, and we are so lucky to have it.
No, I agree, but I do also agree it's a moot point. So let's move forward. I am pro American energy independence, but I think it doesn't have to be. It seems like the argument gets framed this way, Ben, and that you got to be all one way. You have to be a preservationist with no use of our resources out there, or you get framed the other way. You must not care a lick about the environment. I think. The majority of folks who live along the Gulf Coast that are involved somehow with the outdoors or the water or just appreciate having it there are somewhere in between. They say those jobs are important, America's energy independence is important, but darn it, we don't go screwing around again. Don't have the clown show it was in the response in the first couple weeks to the oil spill.
Well, and it was because of the water depths. You know, that's why it was such a fiasco. The other problem, though, of course, were the contingency plans. They were decades old. There was a one-size-fits-all plan made for that every company in the Gulf used. I wrote about it when it happened. The plan for a major oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico called for setting up an office with a wall clock, a fax machine, a computer. I mean, literally, this is what these federal plans called for. You know, a computer. And it's just absurd how that was approved by our government. And, you know, there have been a lot of stories since the oil spill. They got rid of the old acronym MMS for the Minerals Management Service because it was discovered how chummy the agency had been with the industry. And you know, we still have that that same problem in the regulatory world, because oil drilling is so complicated. And at this point, it's space age stuff, what they're doing. You know, they are literally using incredible technology to be able to get down there 5,000 feet. So the people who understand it are mostly making tons of money in the oil industry as opposed to working for the government. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So our understanding and ability to even regulate what the industry is doing, we can never keep up because they're constantly pushing this new frontier because there's so much money to be made. So we're always going to be behind and just have to hope that they can solve the problem.
Yeah, but let's not be fax machine and one computer behind, Ben.
Right.
Yeah, let's be
point. Right. Last time I checked, and I haven't done it in a couple years, but they said that there was always going to be oil boom on the Gulf Coast. The last time I checked the warehouses, you used to be able to do it online.
Mm-hmm.
This is 3 years after the spill. There was still 0.0 feet of fire boom on the Gulf Coast, which could have solved all the problems if we'd had any back then. They could have burned all the oil at the site, which is what the plans called for.
Yep.
The same plan with the wall clock wanted you to use fire boom, but there was no fire boom.
Y'all remember that? Y'all remember what Ben's talking about? We talked about that so many times because so many people would say, calling the show and say, well, why don't they just surround it with boom and burn it off and get it out there? And we didn't have the boom.
No, that was a story I broke here from Mobile. It was a national story. And, you know, the way I broke it was a guy who used to be he would have been in charge at NOAA of the oil spill if he hadn't retired. And he called me up and said, look, I know every one of the people we're seeing on these news conferences, they know they're supposed to be burning the oil. Something is wrong. Figure out why they're not burning the oil. See if they even have any fire boom. And so sure enough, I called the big fire boom manufacturer, and they said, yeah, the government just asked if they could borrow a boom because they have zero booms. I mean, and he cussed a lot when he said it, so he was pretty outraged.
Well, if we come back from the break, I want to talk more about that, because I've been told that, you know, we have these facilities here where they do have, you know, things staged and ready to go. I would like to know that we're hopefully way better prepared than we were all those years ago, and maybe, like Ben was talking about, that we're better off than just having a contingency plan that has a fax machine, a computer, and a wall clock. Once again, I thread the very dangerous middle road where I am a fan of energy independence for the United States and the jobs that come from it. But don't be unprepared again. 10 years since the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. BP oil spill. Come right back. We'll take your calls and text too at 343-0106.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Monday. Text line, phone line, 343-0106. Let's fire up the new bumper right here. All right, fire that up.
Fella, why you so nasty? Why you keep yourself so untidy when you wake in the morning time? Don't leave your place, just stay inside. You got to wash
your hands and clean your fingernails.
Now, fella, you mustn't fail.
Wash your hands and clean your fingernails.
Yes, darling, you must prevail.
I'm digging it. I'm digging it. Brand new, like released within the last hour or so. Galactic and Wash Your Hands. Ben's brother, part of that formula. So what the Galactics now have a song ready for all of us. Even afterwards, we could put this for preschool too, right? I mean, it's a good reach.
Absolutely. Now, it's funny, you know, they're putting those songs out there and all, but they're shut down. The band is completely off the road, and they also own Tipitina's, the nightclub in New Orleans, and it's shut down.
So what are they? What are they?
25 employees.
Yeah, what do they do on that? I mean, well, New Orleans. I mean, the whole economy based on. Well, that's not true, but a good portion of the economy based on tourism. They got to have people come in there. People got to go there and buy overpriced drinks and check out music shows, right?
Yeah, and everybody's wondering when they'll be able to get back to doing that. You know, you look at how many cases there are there, and it's pretty frightening. You know, Alabama, we still have a fairly low number of cases overall. I think we've got 4,500 or so.
Yeah, compared to Louisiana.
Look at the states around us.
Yeah.
You know, Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, they've all got a lot of cases.
Well, And that's another question. I want to get the whole conversation I'm having about the reopen. That's a tough thing, even state to state, but inside a state, too. If we start reopening some parts of the state and not others, is it fair to keep a Mobile County closed and a Baldwin County open because of so many fewer cases, right, in Baldwin County? So what about that? You know, if you're in business, you're saying, hey, man, wait a second, my customers now are going to go across the bay, you know, and leave here. A lot of questions here, but I want everybody to know that just before we finish, that song is available right now on YouTube. Your brother Jeff and the band Galactic did this, like everybody, I guess, remoted in to do their part of the song.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great, you can see them all in the little video. They've done a couple since the virus started. It's real, like a lot of the musicians are doing and stuff. They're just fun, though. And to find a song from the 30s called Wash Your Hands, it's great.
And it's, I love the Calypso beat. So yeah. I was in from the first note. All right, and we'll talk about some with the virus, but you know, we're thinking about this in the time of business loss right now, and we're talking about the businesses that can't operate. There was plenty of that 10 years ago. And going forward, businesses that were in, you know, you talk about the beach being shut down, it was shut down.
Oh, yes.
And stayed shut down.
Absolutely. And, you know, my current business is the charter, taking people in the Delta, is shut down. So I feel that sting. You know, the last trip I took was in March, mid-March. I think it was March 16th. I had a family fly in from New York, two parents and two kids, to go with the grandparents who live in Mobile. And the New York family, the parents and the kids, were all sick.
Oh,
and
wow.
Runny noses and the whole deal. And I spent the whole day with them, and afterward I canceled every spring trip I had.
Did you end up getting sick at all, or did you?
No, I didn't, not that I know of. And, you know, that's the other scary part about this whole situation, of course, is you might have it and not know. But that was enough of a, you know, I saw those kids, their noses running all over the deck of my boat all day, and just thought, oh, gosh.
You know, I want to talk about that some more, and also remind folks just joining us, talking to Ben Raines, and we're talking about 10 years since the BP oil spill in the Gulf. David says on the text, the sad part is where we are today with oil drilling in the Gulf is where we're going to be in 10 years from now when it comes to public health readiness for a pandemic. So,
what a great point.
So, but it doesn't, see, my frustration, and maybe it's still the idealistic person left in me after all these years, doesn't have to be that way. And I think there's a demand for those of us who are, I am not anti-drilling, I'm pro-American energy, but with that, I think it is fair for we the people, to, especially the people on the front lines, and that's us here on the Northern Gulf Coast, to demand that we're ready to go, that if something, God forbid, happens, we aren't searching for boom. We aren't searching for, you know, how we're going to get the boats out there. We aren't searching for the plan. We need to have that ready.
Yeah, and it's one of those problems where the failure rate is so low, you know, it's like we wouldn't have fire departments if people's houses never burned down.
Right.
And we almost never have these big spills. But when we do, they're catastrophic. You know, there's another spill still going in the Gulf
mm-hmm.
that has... Yeah, and it's been going on for two decades, and they can't stop it. The seafloor is so fractured, it's just coming out all over, and there's nothing to cap. You know, so there's plenty of room for better technology, I would say that, to make sure things are safe.
Now let's talk about this from the environmental front. And one thing we talked about over and over again back then was, okay, we have these effects that we're seeing now, these simple effects, but do we know, and we often would say, what's it going to look like in 10 years from now? And so what does it look like in 10 years from now? Have we seen chronic effects after the acute effects are gone?
Well, we have, and we've also seen something really interesting. I just read a paper the other day. They're seeing the shadow of the oil in all kinds of creatures. They can see carbon that they know was related to the spill by the, you know, different isotopes and things at a molecular level. And it's all throughout the food chain. Now, in minute amounts that don't matter,
mm-hmm.
you know, that don't even hurt the creatures, but it's detectable. It's just spread everywhere. The big fears after the spill, and this is talking to all the state scientists in particular, was what was happening to the benthic communities, creatures that live on the bottom. And particularly we're talking about things that we eat, like flounder and crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first 4 or 5 years, both were way down in Alabama, in testing. And then crabs had a rebound first. Flounder are just starting to come back well. There were, I think, you know, last year I think our numbers were about back to normal for flounder. but they were way off for 6 or 7 years. And it, you know, you just have to think of what happened on the bottom. All the oxygen disappeared. You know, not that it got coated in oil, but the creatures that ate it died and caused massive oxygen depletions, and that actually killed a lot of things. Then there may have been some other effects that lingered. If you went in the Gulf during the oil spill, when they were, you know, they were sinking all that oil and all that stuff. If you went in the Gulf off Alabama, and I have pictures of this, and swam in 5 feet of water, 10 feet of water, the bottom was coated in this layer of this brown stuff. It was almost like a brown snow had fallen all over the bottom of the Gulf. And what that was all these algae that ate the oil, and they were dying. But their bodies, they had eaten the oil. You know, so there was this. I was always scared about that. You know, what it would mean. And I had the stuff tested. We gathered some up and actually sent it to Ed Overton, who was the lead tester for at LSU, but for the entire nation. He was the man who was fingerprinting the oil. And he said that stuff all over the bottom was BP oil, but it had been degraded by the bacteria, but the fingerprint of the oil was still present. And I think that's why we had the problems with the flounder and the crabs.
Okay, coming right back, more with Ben Raines. We're going to talk about 10 years ago, the BP oil spill, and also a story more recent. Of course, we've been talking with him about the find of the Clotilda, and the story came up last week. We talked about the state getting possession of the Clotilda. What's his take on that? We'll find out more when we return right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:35, FM Talk 106.5. And Midday Mobile on this Monday, talking to my buddy Ben Raines and talking about the reporting and our conversations we were having several times a week 10 years ago here on FM Talk 106.5, trying to navigate what was then a open oil spill. 87 days, am I right? Wasn't it 87 or 88 days, something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And it was like mid-July when they put the... Remember, we had gone through the top hat and then the cap, yeah. And the... all the y'all
the
remember all that? All the ideas and people had that we're going to try to stop the leak, and then we're talking about cleaning it up as well. You mentioned something about, you know, we all learned about blowout preventers and all that back then, but... Maybe did they learn a lesson on how to come in and maybe cap if they have a somewhat similar situation in the future?
Yeah, I think they did, and they acknowledged that ultimately. At least Thad Allen, the Coast Guard Captain Admiral that led the response, when I asked him directly, and it was that they should have. You know, when you have a bad pipe at your house, you cut off the bad part and put new pipe, and that's what some oil engineers were advocating from the earliest days of the spill, and apparently that's what BP wanted to do. But the government wouldn't let them because of this idea that somehow the kinked pipe was keeping the oil in and limiting the flow, which was absurd. It wasn't at all. But ultimately what worked was cutting off the broken part of the pipe where it was damaged and putting on a brand new blowout preventer. That's all that thing was that we heard so much about. You know, it was standard technology they already had. And they probably could have done it a week or two after the thing started if they'd been brave enough.
One last before we shift here to the Clotilda, but you mentioned, because I sit and wonder if we have what we need here for response along the Northern Gulf Coast, and you said there's three items or a couple items here that you think are must-haves for the response.
Well, one is you know, basically a blowout preventer, like I'm talking about, that you can deploy in situations like this.
Okay.
The other would be fire boom. So that you can round up oil at the site, especially if it's 100 miles offshore, like this was from Alabama. You know, that's a lot of time to deal with the oil. So you got to have fire boom, which we had none of last time. And then I think you got to have Corexit again, and lots of it. And that was very controversial, but all the scientists I know think that we did the right thing because we limited damage to the Gulf by every drop of oil that didn't make it ashore. And, you know, it's sad what happened at 5,000 feet out there, but that water is very old water, and it stays there. It does not really move around. And there are all kinds of ecosystem services, you know, from the deep benthic corals and all that stuff. But the fact is, there are a lot more services performed by the near-shore environment. You know, water less than 300 feet deep. That's where so much of the life that we need and count on comes from. So those would be my three things.
Okay.
And of course, that's going to be very controversial. All these people are still suing, claiming Corexit gave them cancer, even though they were in cities, you know, 200 miles away or 100 miles away from where they were using the stuff.
Yeah, just say where they took the money from down here on the coast and took it 200 miles north into the state.
So
it's very similar. Maybe it traveled with the money. Maybe the Corexit was on the money that went up there. All right, before we run out of time, I do want to get an update here as we've talked over time about the discovery of the Clotilda and everything going on. Last time we had talked, there was a question about who was the rightful owner of the Clotilda? Who would take possession of it? You were saying you thought at that point it would be the state. It looks like that's what happened, right?
And that's, you know, under federal law and the way most of the, you know, admiralty laws and all that, the way Alabama state law is written, things found in state waters that are older than 50 years old become the property of the state unless you can make a claim otherwise. So when this all, you know, after the ship was confirmed, I got a letter in the mail from the Admiralty Court, and they were inviting me to make a claim, saying I was an interested party, and they were having a hearing to determine ownership and everything. And the state had made a claim, and I chose not to. I mean, I don't know what I would do with a sunken ship.
Right.
I certainly don't have the resources to handle it. But now that the state does own it, which was almost completely 100% going to be the outcome, even if people had challenged it, then it becomes what to do with it. And that's, you know, right now that's up to the state. And I would tell you that members of the Descendants Association in the Clotilda Descendants Association are not real confident the state is going to do the right thing. And they, you know, they come from a lifetime of experience in Alabama dealing with the state on various issues. They very much want whatever wreck remains dug up and put on display so it can become, you know, a cultural touchstone and a tourist attraction and just a powerful artifact. And, you know, there's no guarantee that's going to happen right now.
So it could be for the state could decide it's not, you know, what I worried about it before is the state would take it to Montgomery or the state would make a deal with the feds to take it to Washington, but could the state decide to do nothing?
The state could decide to do nothing, yes. They could decide to leave it in place and do nothing. They could decide to dig around inside it in the water still and do nothing. You know, the next steps are going to be very expensive, and of course Alabama is always broke. But when I say very expensive, we're talking, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And that's what it's cost to get these other things up. When you hear about the Viking ships they pulled up in the harbor in Stockholm or the Hunley or the ironclads, different places, it's very expensive because, to get the Clotilda up, they would build a cofferdam around it, which is basically a hole in the water. You know, you build this wall in the water and then suck all the water out of the ring you've made. So you can work on dry ground on the bottom of the river. Well, that's about $10 million to do one large enough for the Clotilda in the environment it's in, which is the Mobile River, which experiences annual floods and extreme flows and all that. So, you know, we're talking about a pretty robust piece of structure that has to be built to dig it up. So that's the issue. Could the state come up with enough money to do it? Probably not. Could the feds? Of course. But there has to be an appetite. Could private, you know, people? My position is if the state announces they're not going to dig it up, I'm going to start a GoFundMe to raise money to dig it up, and I'm going to make sure Oprah learns about it.
Right. Yes, because she's got the deepest pockets of all. But, I mean, I would, if the state goes to the feds may say yes, but we're going to pull this and put this at the Smithsonian or something like that, right? I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, the state is on record saying the wreck should stay in Mobile. They said that at the first meeting when the first ship that I found, the wrong ship, was found. And they said it several times again, and I made them say it on the record by asking them in front of people and stuff like that. But, you know, the thing about the Clotilda is it can go a lot of places. You know, the bulk of it can stay here, but, you know, the Smithsonian, they have a piece of a slave ship from South America, and it is about the size of a brick. And that's the only thing they've got there. So, you know, here we've got a 90-foot-long ship that's 28 feet wide. There could be a lot of little pieces that go to a lot of places, including the Smithsonian. We could give them a, you know, brick-sized piece of the Clotilda. But I know the people in Africa want pieces in their museum to make the connection to there, that, you know, these people came from here, and this is a piece of the ship that brought them.
So
the ownership question is interesting. It's really more about what they decide to do with the wreck, and I hope they do the right thing, which is dig it up and put it on display. It's an internationally important artifact.
And do it right here in Mobile.
And do it right here in Mobile, absolutely. It should be here because the people are here, the story is here, and what better place to tell it? You know, and we're right on the Civil Rights Trail. That new lynching museum in Montgomery attracts, you know, $1 billion worth of economic activity every year. Well, I think Mobile could use a little of that. Certainly Africatown could.
Well said. Well said, Ben. And remind folks, too, I mean, you're not doing it now, but as soon as we get back to work and they do open up for tours of the Delta and all that, people can probably, can you just at least get them information and get people pre-booked?
Yeah. So I've actually been going out a little in the boat up in the Delta. I put up a few little Facebook live videos, you know, with the lilies blooming and stuff like that, or just pretty stuff. And I put up on my Facebook page, I put up links to America's Amazon, the documentary about the Delta, and the Underwater Forest. And you can click on those and watch them on YouTube for free.
They're fantastic documentaries, y'all. Make sure to do that and just search Ben Rains on Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. And they can be my friend if they like. I never say no to a friend.
There we go. Great stuff, Ben. Thank you, brother.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
Ben Rains, check it in. And we're coming right back. We'll take it to Huntsville, where the first of the Reopen Alabama rallies is supposed to be going down in about 10 minutes. We'll do that next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
1250 FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile on this Monday. And a big thank you to Ben Rains. And we'll talk more about 10 years since the Deepwater Horizon, the BP oil spill, coming up next hour. Were you any better off and being ready to respond 10 years later? We'll talk about that coming up in just a little bit. I said we're going to take you to Huntsville, and we do that by calling the telephone of my friend Dale Jackson with WVNN, Dale Jackson Show in Huntsville. And we are telephonically communicating now with the site of what is Alabama's Boston Tea Party, the Reopen Alabama event in Huntsville. What? No? Hey, Dale.
No. No, that is not the case. That is not what's happening. It was a sad little display of about 10 people, I'll be kind. About 10 people, including a kid carrying a Fire Fauci sign for some reason. I don't know what Fauci did to anybody, but all right. We're all mad at him. So about 10 people. You know what I find odd about this is Republicans and conservatives, which I'm assuming most of these groups are, constantly say things like, well, we have jobs and we can't protest. It's like, not in this case, you know.
Maybe because they're at home now. Maybe because the draconian rules here in Alabama have kept them from going to work. Which, I mean, I got to be frank with you. There are a lot of people I know that aren't doing, you know, if they're telecommuting or not going to work at all. I mean, there's some people. Maybe
don't
they
ruin my thing. Don't step all over.
I hate throwing facts into the mix, but the fact is this. Idea that this grassroots, it was rumbling through Facebook that it was going to be massive. You said about 10 people were there?
Yeah, about 10 people showed up. And, you know, the internet's not real life. We all know that. And it's more clear every single day that I think most people in general understand what's happening right now. Most don't like it. A majority don't like it, I'm sure. But I think they're okay. I also think a lot of people see a light at the end of the tunnel, especially here in Alabama. For the heavier handed stuff that's going on, where, and I don't mean heavier handed by government, but I mean just the more shutdown, shelter in place, stay at home stuff. I think people see a light at the end of the tunnel, and I think that they're willing to ride it out.
Yeah, that was in the time frame, Dale. It's good to hear you say that because I wondered the same thing. It seems like, I don't know, it's too little, too late, but it seems like it's too late when we have, now I don't know what the governor is going to decide or Scott Harris, but you've got what came out last week from the committee there and lieutenant governor. Yeah, I think people say, yeah, let's not mess this up now. Let's just get this thing opened back up as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about the idea that it is very stupid that you tell me that in my neighborhood I can't congregate with my neighbors. But if we all wanted to go to Walmart and see each other, we could.
Right.
We can't do anything at our house on six people over. But if every person in my neighborhood wanted to go to the grocery store, well, it's a Walmart, it's the closest one. We can all go there and do that. So we'll all go to the exact same location. It doesn't make any sense to close the businesses the way they did. So I understand them wanting them open, but I think we've already pulled the trigger, and undoing it is not going to be easy. And I don't foresee them just saying, okay, fine, small retail establishments, you're back open. And another thing, just before we continue, it's also very easy for politicians that don't have to make decisions to say things like we should this, and this, and then the person who has to actually do it has to make the different decisions. I think that's easy to do.
Were you referring to the what came out from Lieutenant Governor and the crew, or who are you talking about specifically?
Well, no, I am talking about that. I got off the phone, actually, with Will Ainsworth about 10 minutes ago, and we were just talking about this a little bit, and we were discussing his thing, and I told him, and I'll say this, I said this on the air, you know, he's making a recommendation, and they're not, there was never any indication that he was going to make that recommendation and KIV was going to go. We've seen the recommendation that he put out 2 hours ago, and okay, cool, open it up. And I think everyone knows that. So I think that we're still a couple of days away from anything. Maybe she may come out tomorrow or today and say, hey, we're going to do this, but it's not going to be open it up. Look, Trump's thing said 14 days of decline, right? Well, if you look at the numbers, the average day of decline, or the average of 7-day average, we're on a decline right now, about day six of that. So we need an additional 8 days. And that puts us at April 28th. Okay, open up May 1st. I just think that's where we're going.
What about the flip side of this? And I heard that it was, I think, Louisiana Senator Kennedy had talked about it. Several people have, but I heard it last week, and maybe it needs to be spoken more of, that if we open things back up, there's a pretty good chance we'll see another little, you know, spike, because now there'll be more people out, more chances to try to get people ready for that, so it doesn't turn, you know, it doesn't turn right back into a shutdown, that we open back up, and then, okay, well, here's Scott Harris saying we had an increase in cases, and boom, we shut it right back down.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's why I think you just get it down as low as you can with some reasonability. And, you know, I hate to say, it just sounds so stupid because it's like, oh, May 1st. That's just a nice round date. But what does that date mean? Nothing in reality. But, you know, I don't know the answer here, because I went out today and got a COVID-19 antibody test. They have them here in North Alabama. So I paid the $50 and ran out and got one negative. So I was almost positive that I had it. But according to this thing, I don't, and I never did. And so, you know, that means that if I don't have it and I run into someone who does, I could get it. You know what I mean?
But
so,
you could have it tomorrow. I mean, you could that's one thing about the test. They're fine,
right,
but you get the test, and it gives you some false sense of security because, you know, in stopping on the way home from when you got the test, you picked up the virus, and now you got it.
Oh, no, I agree with that. What my point is, it was an antibody test to see if I had ever got it before.
Sure. Like, everybody's assumed.
I had thought for sure that I did. And my wife, I absolutely thought that she had had it, because she had had a really bad illness that we thought was maybe the flu, but she went and got a flu test and didn't have it. Now, she's going to go get the test today when she gets done working, but I'm very surprised I didn't have it. My point in all that is that we just don't know. Everything is still a question mark. And because of that, everyone can just assign whatever motives they want to their enemies, the voters to themselves, and they can just say whatever they want to say because nobody knows anything. And that's just the scariest part of the whole thing.
And that's the problem, though. Instead of being able to, for some of us, instead of being able to say, man, I don't know anything, I'm trying to figure this out, everybody's, you know, pretty sure that, well, if I haven't gotten it, it means this, that, and the other. And, you know, what your reaction, that's an honest reaction, figuring you probably already have it. If I talk to, you know, 20 people, not all in one place, but if I talk to 20 people, 15 of them tell me, yeah, same thing you said, I was sick, or so-and-so in my house was sick earlier in the year. I think it's been here for a lot longer. I think we've already had it.
Yeah, and I got one of these stupid 2-year-old babies running around, so I assume that he brought it into this house.
Yes.
And now I learned that, at least not to me, and if she got it and I did, I mean, our marriage might be over.
I'm going to quote you on that. I've got that recording, that audio.
She's sitting right here, so that's not fine.
Well, good. I'm still documenting that. And so do you think the, with 1 minute left here, the political play of this, beyond just the health side of it, the business side of it, do you think we're going to see continued wins for Will Ainsworth out of this over Governor Ivey? At one point, it was the I-10 Mobile River Bridge. Now it's a discussion of reopening the state. What do you think? Getting traction?
Yeah. I mean, just think about it. Even if she opens it up tomorrow, it's because of Will Ainsworth. If she doesn't open it up until the 1st, Will Ainsworth told her she should have done it sooner. I mean, politically, I mean, it's a win for him. I mean, I don't think he's viewing it through that prism. But I mean, if you were judging this, I know baseball season's not happening. But if I was at a Trash Pandas game. And
oh, shut up.
That'd be a 3-for-3, right? Oh, sorry, the Mobile Bay Bears. A 3-for-3, I guess, right?
You had to go there, didn't you? You had to go there. Enjoy your non-baseball season. Yeah, we're enjoying it the same way down here.
I had my opening day tickets. I was ready to go. I was going to go to the game in Birmingham. All washed out.
Yeah. See, that's what happens when you take our team. Dale, as always, man, I appreciate your time and your frankness on this. We'll check back soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, Dale Jackson for the Dale Jackson Show on WVNN in Huntsville, site of today's first Reopen Alabama rally. That he said he was being charitable and said 10 people were there. What about tomorrow's in Montgomery? Can they do the double digits? Can they make 20? Keep an eye on that. Coming right back.